having a chat. It's always motivating to meet someone who's enthusiastic about the same problems and challenges that we face.
That's why I've changed my disciplines about 5 times in my career.
Well, too many interesting things, right? So.
No, I think it's just like, what do you think? No, but I have. I've changed so many times. That's what keeps it interesting.
I agree. Would you see us bouncing around? Because I have a couple of students coming, so I put a slide up just to give a shout out. Because it's the collective group, right? That incubates ideas, but they're working in protein biochemistry, which is very different from what I'm going to talk about tonight.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I'm not interested.
You just won't mention them tonight. Yeah. So that's kind of my final thing. I'm just going to go over one more time.
See how the momentum is going if I need to wrap up.
I'll just indicate that we're getting close. But you know, if you have a couple minutes. No one's coming after you.
Yeah. What year did you finish your PhD? Good evening, everyone. My name is Professor Corey Bradshaw. My position is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology, which doesn't have nothing to do with tonight's talk, but we have related interests, and in fact, I've met Justin a few times, your speaker tonight, and we have quite a bit in common, as it turns out, so I'm very privileged to introduce him tonight. First, I want to acknowledge country. We are meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people and of the Adelaide Plains. We pay respect to their elders living and past. And we respect their cultural heritage, beliefs, and relationship with the land and the sea. And we acknowledge that they are a continuing part of the Kaurna people living today. So some housekeeping first. We've got emergency exits on either side of the foyer and toilets on the left-hand side. And if there is a problem, the meeting point is on Victoria Square side. Okay, hopefully nothing bad will happen. So this is part of we had some debate whether it was the second or third, but we've decided it is indeed the third lecture in the Brave series that Flinders is putting on. It's not just a rebranding, but a new approach to getting out some of the very exciting research that Flinders is doing. And it's Flinders, of course, takes its name from Captain Matthew Flinders, the first person to circumnavigate Australia. And we sort of use that as a symbol of new discovery and new research, of very exciting and broad-scale thinking with our researchers. Now, we can talk about some of our past stars, if you will, of Flinders' research, including people like Professor Colin Raston, who's one of the pioneers of green chemistry, and we'll hear a little bit about that tonight, as well as people like Damien Riggs, who is sort of very well known for dabbling in areas that no sane person would do if you didn't want to invite controversy, things like racial issues, whiteness and gender fluidity. So tackling sort of every side of the scientific to the social science spectrum. Now, tonight, we're going to hear from a very experienced and celebrated researcher, Dr. Justin Chalker. Justin received his PhD back in 2012 from Oxford University. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and then before he came to Flinders, he was briefly employed at the University of Tulsa. And I guess one of the reasons he came to Flinders was that he got a very prestigious Discovery Early Career Research Award from the Australian Research Council. I can guarantee you that that's a highly coveted and very competitive award and grant. And you'll see why today, just some of the amazing things that Justin and his team does. Now, Justin's also won the Tall Poppy of the Year of South Australia in 2016, which I won that a while ago, 2008, but it's since moved on and there's much better competition these days. So it's not only just sort of high-flying researchers, but also their ability to communicate. And Justin's been recently recognized again for his ability to communicate as being one of the Essay Science Award recipients of STEM Educator of the Year, so that's Science, Technology, Engineering, and Maths. And he was a finalist for the Eureka Prizes in the Early Career Researcher category. So, you know, this is one of your hot researchers right here. So I would very much like you to help me ask him to come to the stage and welcome Justin Chalker. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Corey, for the very kind introduction. A lot to live up to now when I give this talk. And thank you to Flinders University for sponsoring this event, this brave lecture. And before I move on to the actual research that we'll do, I want to acknowledge that this is a team effort, and I'm the spokesman for this very talented and dedicated team of students, postdocs, and professional researchers at Flinders University. And some of these students and members of our research team are here in the audience, so if you recognize them and bump into them after the talk, do feel free to ask them a little bit more about what they're up to. And our overall mission as synthetic chemists is to make interesting molecules. I've always been fascinated with the idea that you can make a molecule known with atomic precision, and that molecule may have never existed in the history of the universe as far as we know, and it might even be useful. And we try to make these molecules and these materials for two overall objectives. One of them is in chemical biology. So half of my lab works in this area of protein science. I won't talk about this tonight, but I think it's important to acknowledge some of the key players in our research team because as a team, they work with each other and support each other in all projects that we'll work on, including the main ones that I'll talk about tonight. We're interested in developing new ways to mutate proteins using selective reactions rather than modifying DNA. We're interested in evolving bacteria to put in unnatural amino acids and expand the genetic code so we can use these unique amino acids to label them with something that allows us to see these proteins in the body, perhaps for medical imaging. And so Kim Scroggie is in the audience tonight. If you're interested in that, you can pick her brain after the talk. Lisa Alcock, a very talented researcher, she's now as part of her PhD at Cambridge for 1 year on an Endeavor scholarship, and she's invented a tool, a new molecule, that can map how proteins behave in response to oxidative stress, an important goal in understanding the progression of cancer, aging, and many other cell states and diseases. But this is going to be the primary focus of tonight's talk, and that's our lab's interest in making sustainable materials, making useful substances from something that can be renewable, or perhaps even entirely from waste. And one of our featured materials will be taking something like a triglyceride, even used cooking oil, reacting it with elemental sulfur, which is produced in 70 million tons every year by petroleum refining. So it's a byproduct, a waste product of the petroleum industry. And we can make a material that, in principle, every atom is derived from waste, and that material is actually quite good at doing things like cleaning up oil spills, capturing toxic mercury pollution, and perhaps we can use this as a replacement for mercury in situations where mercury is used intentionally, as it is in artisanal gold mining. So how did we get started in this whole space? Because our primary motivation was actually making sustainable materials. It's very visible now in the news and the popular media about plastic pollution, persistent compounds that we as chemists have made, and they're quite durable and they don't break down. And that can be useful for many applications, but it's not useful in the design of the lifetime of these materials. And so our goal at the outset of this project was not necessarily to deal with the challenging issues of pollution. It was to explore ways in which we can make sustainable plastics that perhaps have a programmed lifetime that can break down in the environment and provide innocuous materials, or things that can be more generally recycled or repurposed or broken down and made into something new. That was our primary motivation. It turns out that in this journey, we've been able to use some of these materials, these candidates for these sustainable plastics and polymers and materials, and because of their utility in capturing pollution, that's taken us into situations like mercury pollution from artisanal gold mining, oil spills, and capturing mercury in air pollution. And so our original thinking went something like this. This is what we do now. This is the vast majority of polymers that are produced on our planet. And we make more than 100 million tons of plastic every year, of which maybe 2% are recycled. Okay? So that has to go somewhere. Maybe we're using it. Maybe we're tossing it in a landfill. Maybe it gets lost at sea in the ocean. So we need to actually rethink this cycle right here, where we're using raw materials, we're making remarkable and useful things, but this right here, the end of life, is something that we need to deal with now. And so what we're working towards, and this will be beyond our lifetime, so we're setting the foundation for a small contribution to dealing with this problem, is we can make some type of circular economy where we're using raw materials, ideally things that are renewable or they're already in circulation. We can devise new chemistry, new ways, new processing to make useful things, but at the end of their lifetime, can we recycle them? Can we dismantle them and make entirely new substances and close this loop here? And if in the process you make some waste, can we actually valorize that waste and convert it into something that can benefit the environment or be incorporated back into this cycle? So that's our motivation for doing this project here. And specifically, we're taking things like unsaturated triglycerides, waste cooking oil. We go down to the tavern or the local fish and chip shop, and we get 20 liters of used cooking oil. We use that as our starting material. We have a lean budget in our lab. Or perhaps we can use elemental sulfur. So this picture right here, this is outside of Vancouver. There's a lot of sulfur in petroleum oil, and we rightfully desulfurize it. We remove the sulfur from crude oil when we refine it. So when we burn petrol and diesel, we're not emitting sulfur dioxide, which gets converted into sulfuric acid in acid rain. So that's a good thing. But because we refine so much crude oil, we have 70 million tons of this produced every year, and we don't have anything to do with it. We can convert it into sulfuric acid, and that's one of the most widely produced commodity chemicals on the planet, but we still have an excess sulfur problem. If you go to the UAE, you have megaton deposits of sulfur, mountains of this stuff, waiting to be used. So if you can devise something useful to make from this, perhaps some type of new polymer, new plastic material, we can deal with this sulfur problem. It's very cheap. It's a negative cost in some cases. They'll pay you to take it away. And we can contribute to this circular economy. And so I'll tell you a story about how we've made this material, and I'm going to give you three case studies on how we've used it in an environmental application, in oil spill remediation, in mercury remediation, and as a replacement for mercury and mining processes. So we're taking waste and we're converting it into an entirely new material, and we're using that in a way that benefits the environment. That's our goal. Like I said before, there's a lot of sulfur around. And I have to give credit to some of the pioneers in this field, because as we started this project, we were looking to many different sources of renewable or sustainable building blocks to make these useful things, things that are sourced from plants, things that are byproducts, non-traditional building blocks, things that are classically ignored. And I would argue that sulfur is one of them. And there was a paper in Nature Chemistry in 2013 by Jeff Pune at the University of Arizona that really inspired us to move into this field. And we were actually working on something quite similar at the time. And so this really kick-started us. It gave us the nudge to move into this area to look at sulfur materials. And so they took sulfur. Sulfur is this beautiful yellow powder. If you melt sulfur at about 120, it turns into a yellow liquid. If you continue to heat it, you can break these weak sulfur-sulfur bonds. It reacts with another molecule of sulfur, and it ring opens this cyclic structure here, and you get long chains of sulfur. And if you leave that, it gradually wraps back up and forms the most stable form of sulfur, this S8 yellow powder. But what they found is that you can trap this with a compound that contains a carbon-carbon double bond, and you can make a stable plastic. So why were they actually making plastics out of sulfur? when we've done very similar things in vulcanization of rubber, but in that case you have an organic polymer, largely a carbon backbone, and you're cross-linking it with a low percentage of sulfur, 2 to 10%. These materials contain 50, 60, 70, all the way to 90% sulfur by mass, which is quite remarkable. They're distinct chemically from all of the polymers that we typically interact with. Think of every type of plastic, coating, paint, rubber. These are completely distinct because their backbones are made from sulfur. So why were they interested in doing that? They were targeting more high-end applications, things like making new electroactive materials so that they can develop lithium sulfur batteries. These materials have an interesting property that because you have this sulfur-sulfur backbone, they're dynamic, and you can fix these things just by heating them, so you can actually repair defects in these polymers. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. So these are healable materials. They have an interesting optical properties as well. They let through the wavelength of IR light that's useful in night vision, so they're actually making these night vision lenses, and if they're healable, if you damage them, you can repair them just by heating them with a heat gun. So really cool, high-end stuff. And when we got into this area, we said, that's great. These are really entertaining papers, and maybe someone will actually use these things. But these are quite high-end applications. So if you're going to argue that you're going to make a dent in the excess sulfur problem, these are not the applications that are going to do that. So our motivation was instead to use cross-linkers, these things like canola oil, that are produced on the same scale as sulfur, and target problems that are commensurate with this amount of sulfur that you have laying around the globe. So we're looking at applications in environmental remediation. We're looking at applications in agriculture, new building materials, think large scale. We have a sustainable, long access to these type of materials. Can we apply them in this space? And our collaborator, Tom Hazel, at the University of Liverpool, were working on designing these materials to help deal with this sustainability and recyclability aspect. So normally, when you have something called a thermoset polymer, like a ceramic, it's locked in. You can't actually recycle it. It's cross-linked and it's so stable that when you try to heat it up, it won't break down. It actually becomes more and more intractable, more strong, rigid, and durable. In contrast, if you have these polymers with these sulfur-sulfur backbone, you can actually break these things apart. You can literally shatter these with a hammer. So this is a figure from our collaborators group, Tom Hazel at Liverpool. And then you can reform these. This is not merely melting it like you do for a lot of plastic recycling. This is actually reorganizing the bonds to make an entirely new material. And this is a new concept in recycling polymers. And Tom and I are working on general design principles. So if you want to make a liquid or a soft rubber or hard glass or something in between, we're working on the principles that are required to tune in those mechanical properties into these molecules. And you'll hear more about that in the next couple of years. For now, I'm going to tell you about our canola oil polymer. Okay, so this is typically made with 50% sulfur, 50% used cooking oil by mass. And this is what this beast looks like. So it's a squishy, friable, you can tear it, rubber. And the reason we looked at canola oil is because it's renewable. It's grown worldwide on all inhabitable continents. It's inexpensive, so it's less than $1 per kilo on commodity scales. And it actually has been used to react with sulfur before, but in low amounts of sulfur. We're talking 5, 10% to make a rubber additive that's used in things like pencil erasers. So there are some precedents for this chemistry. But we wanted to make this material, which is known in the industry as Factus, we wanted to make it with high sulfur content. Okay. And that's what, so Max Worthington here, so I'll give a shout out to the PhD students who did all of the work, all of the hands-on experiments, and the ones who are actually brave and dealing with all of these challenges that we're facing. He figured out the conditions to do this to make an entirely new type of rubber. We have a very sophisticated method of making it a particular size. We just put it in a blender and pass it through sieves because we want this to be easy. We want this to be bucket chemistry, where you can literally mix this in a big pot, heat it up, and you have your product. We've also been able to make this material porous by simply adding salt. You put in the salt, the polymer forms around it, you simply wash it with water, the salt's removed, you can reuse that if you like, and this increases the surface area, which is important if you want anything to interact with this polymer, like say a heavy metal or oil. And so here's how we run this reaction now. So Louisa Esdale sorted out some of the process chemistry. For an academic lab, running anything more than 1 kilo is quite an achievement. We regularly run this on 2.5 kilos. And so at any given time, we have between 10 and 20 kilos of this material in our lab. So we can provide it to any collaborator, an industry or environmental group that wants to test it and the applications that I'll tell you about. So scaling this up is not a trivial exercise, and it's one that we've sorted out in our lab. So now, what are we doing with this material? Okay, we have buckets and buckets of this rubber, and it has a lot of sulfur, and it's made from canola oil. And sulfur is quite hydrophobic. It doesn't like to interact with water, and canola oil is an oil, and you know that that doesn't mix with water. And so we had a very simple hypothesis, is that it should be effective in binding to hydrocarbon pollution like oil spills. And so why do we need anything else to deal with oil spills? There are things on the market. Most of those sorbents are made from non-renewable feedstocks. They can't be reused, and it's quite difficult to recover the oil from the sorbents, these materials that suck up oil from oil spill pollution. And if you think back to some of the larger oil spills, so the Deepwater Horizon is one of them, but every year there are hundreds of oil spills all around the world. Most of them are diesel spills in various ports. But these cause significant damage to the local environment. They can even cause harm to the people that live in these coastal areas where the oil is spilled. The Deepwater Horizon, we released nearly 5 million barrels of oil. Only about 17% was recovered directly from the drilling riser, so they actually pumped that back up and recovered the oil. 3% was skimmed. Most of the time, they just corral this and do a controlled burn and burn that off. So if you want to recover the oil, maybe you need something that can bind to the oil and you can actually get it back. And so if you want to make a next generation oil sorbent, you want it to be fast, you want it to take up a lot of oil, it needs to be cheap. You'll see a lot of papers these days where people make the most sophisticated Rube Goldberg device to suck up oil, and they make 1 gram, maybe, and it's great at sucking up crude oil, but it will never, ever be produced on an industrial scale. So we try to make our things practical. This is a one-step process to make this material, and it's made entirely from waste products that we can get on ton scale. We want this to be buoyant, so you can scoop it off the water if you discharge it directly into the environment. Can you get that back? Okay. You don't want it to take up water. You want to actually just take up the oil, and you want to recover the oil, and you want to be able to reuse it. Another motivation for us to work on this is that oil spills disproportionately affect areas of the world that are low in income. So developing regions like the Niger Delta have suffered for years with decades-old active spills, where this oil plagues the waterways that they use for their livelihood. So in these areas, where people used to use for fishing, for a major protein staple, that's no longer possible. And so in the back of our minds, we're thinking, well, if this is so easy to do, if we can actually make this in a bucket, perhaps people who want to deal with this, and nobody wants to pay for remediation, especially in poor parts of the world, perhaps they can even make it themselves and deploy it in the areas that they want to clean up. So does this work? Here's some contact angle measurements. Basically, we're taking a needle, we're dropping in different types of hydrocarbon, of different types of oil onto the polymer. And within seconds, it absorbs diesel fuel, motor oil, crude oil that we've obtained from a wellhead in the Nakatunga oil field in Queensland, and also a really viscous, stinky crude oil from West Texas, the type that you would have seen in the Gulf spill. And it does quite well with all of these. If you just use sulfur, it's actually quite remarkable. Sulfur itself actually binds to oil and coagulates it, but it's quite dense, so it drops down, so it's not easy to recover it. But this actually might be useful for some applications. If we don't make our porous low-density material, this also will sink. But if we make the porous version, where we had the salt in the polymer synthesis, the density is low enough and it floats that it actually aggregates all of the oil together, floats on the top, and you can scoop it out. So something we didn't anticipate was that you can use a powdered form of this polymer, and not only does it interact with the oil, it binds it together in a way that you can just scoop it out. So that solidification or forming a gel is quite useful for recovery. And because this stuff is squishy, you can actually squeeze the oil out. So you drop it into the oil, you recover the particles, and you can just compress them to recover the oil, and you can use the polymer again and again. And here are some screenshots of this in action, but it's actually much more instructive just to see it work. And this is so easy to do that we've actually worked with high school students and even primary students to do science demonstrations to show them how easy this is. You may have caught us on an episode of Scope actually demonstrating this. So we take a lab trip down to the beach. We get some seawater. This is the crude oil that's directly from a wellhead in Texas, a really nasty, stinky, viscous material. And if it's viscous, it's actually often difficult to absorb into these different type of absorbent materials that you use in oil spill remediation. And so the student that was doing this demonstration here, he actually put in more oil or more of the polymer than he needed to. You can see upon contact, it's almost instantaneous. Within seconds, you can see the oil innervate into the pores, but then it actually aggregates together. So we've cast this as a powder or small particles of the polymer, but he leaves it for a minute, so this is time lapse. But you can scoop it out instantaneously. A few seconds is finished. And so you can actually scoop out all of that viscous, nasty oil, and it actually forms a gel. So this is quite a porous net, right? The oil itself would flow through that. So that's an advantage of this material that we didn't anticipate when we first set out to do this experiment. Now, is this the way this would actually be deployed in the environment? Probably not. It's probably more likely that you'll have something like this, where the material is packed into a filter. And so this is, again, a mixture of oil and water, the same crude oil that we obtained from a wellhead in Texas. And as the oil comes in contact to the polymer, it's bound instantly and aggregates and forms a gel. But the water that you can begin to see come through now will come straight through. So we're working with the Maritime Safety Authority in Australia, so the agency that governs all shipping and responses to oil spills, to make a device where it could be housed on the side of a tanker, and you have this filter pass through contaminated areas. It captures the oil, and then you have a piston that compresses it, so you can pump it back in, recover the oil, and reuse this material here. So that's a cute example here, but we want to actually make this on a large scale. In order to do that with the Maritime Safety Authority, they told me I need to give them at least 1 ton of material. So my students have their work cut out for them. All right. So we'll take a break from oil spill remediation, and we'll move on to another application. But just to be clear, this is the same material. So this is a multifunctional polymer. So it's nothing that we've changed. It's actually the same material that you saw capture oil. Is also useful for capturing mercury. And that also is probably not surprising. Sulfur forms a strong bond to heavy metals like mercury. But we wanted to explore the ways in which it might be useful and the many different contexts in which mercury is encountered. And at the start of this project, we had this naive idea that mercury is a heavy metal, it's toxic, and it's bad. So it might be good if we can remove it from, say, air and water. And we actually published a paper that showed a single example of it capturing mercury. And then we had a deluge of different people discussing the unique challenges they face with mercury. And so we learned a lot after this first publication. I'm going to tell you about some of these challenging situations where you encounter mercury. But first, how does this thing work? You can have this polymer. It can be chunks or pieces of powder. You know, we want to make this pretty low tech. And you can pack this into a filter, and you can pass through a solution of, say, inorganic mercury, mercury 2 chloride, and it binds to the sulfur of the polymer. But as it reaches its capacity, something unexpected happens. It actually changes color. It actually turns gray. So if you're capturing inorganic mercury, this color change tells you that you're nearing capacity. You need to replace it. So it's self-indicating. And that's not something that we actually fully understand. We've uncovered that it makes these mercury sulfide nanoparticles, or these mercury-rich nanoparticles. The chemistry behind that is not fully understood by us. We're working on how that happens. And it also reacts with mercury metal, okay? And it's not just a physical absorption. Most of the products that people use to capture mercury, it's just a physical absorption. Our polymer is distinct in that it actually reacts and oxidizes mercury, and that's quite important because if you go from our polymer here and mercury metal, which can be in a gas or liquid, it actually oxidizes it to mercury 2 sulfide, something called cinnabar. Okay? Cinnabar is so insoluble that you can actually ingest it. It's actually used as a traditional remedy in some parts of the world. Now, I'm not advocating eating any type of mercury sulfide, But you could ingest this, and it probably wouldn't do much harm. We've actually done toxicity studies where we took the polymer saturated with mercury 2, or after it's bound to mercury metal, we put them in liver cell culture, and there was no effect whatsoever. The cells lived as if nothing was happening. It's basically just a fancy leaching experiment. So the mercury, once it's attached to the polymer, doesn't come off. And that's quite important. And if it's converted into an inorganic sulfide, it's no longer volatile, so you're not going to breathe the mercury metal. And it's quite sensitive for this color change. So again, it's self-indicating when you're nearing saturation. So it's not very, the color change is not good as a sensor for low-level amounts. But if you're using this in a filter or in a flue stack, and it starts to change color, you know that you need to replace it. Okay? This just proves that the mercury is on the surface. Now, why do we need to worry about capturing mercury? Mercury is encountered in all sorts of sectors of industry. The oil and gas industry are quite serious about capturing mercury because when you refine oil and natural gas, you encounter loads of mercury, mainly by the virtue of the sheer volume of things that you're refining. And this mercury metal in the refining process that's encountered, it can form an amalgam with their aluminum heat exchangers, and those are very expensive. So the oil and gas industry is quite serious about capturing mercury. And so they use very expensive things like zeolites impregnated with silver metal. So this is the inverse of the mining problem. They're actually using precious metals to capture this mercury. So perhaps we can give them something cheaper to capture that mercury. And they want to do that so it doesn't corrode the valuable equipment, because if it fails, they put their workers and the environment at risk. Mercury is encountered in coal combustion. You burn coal, you're going to emit mercury into the air. Australia does a reasonably good job of capturing that mercury, but it just goes into an ash pit. So you have all of this fly ash that's just put into a pit, and mercury stays there indefinitely, apparently. Chloralkali plants still use mercury-based cells to make sodium hydroxide and chlorine. So in the production of bleach, many of these factories still have heaps of mercury in their wastewater. And if they're ever decommissioned and you have thousands of kilos of mercury, that could be a serious problem to deal with. In Australia, the largest source of mercury emissions is not from burning coal, though that is a major contributor. It's actually using a mercury-based fungicide by sugarcane growers. I'm going to tell you a story about this in a moment. So this isn't a problem that's foreign, that's in the distance. This is a problem that affects us here in Australia. All right? And this is one of the reasons why Australia has not yet ratified the Minamata Convention, the treaty that governs mercury use and trade. Okay? We're a signatory to the convention, but we have not ratified it. The largest source of mercury pollution, which we'll talk about later, is in artisanal and small-scale gold mining. But let's start with this fungicide. Here we go. Here's one that I bought at a local farm supply store. This fungicide contains 120 grams per liter of an alkyl mercury compound. These are extraordinarily toxic. These are compounds that can go through the skin, and these compounds can cause neurological damage, they can cause damage to your kidneys, and they can cause death. And these are used by probably 80 to 90% of all cane growers. And this is legal in Australia. And here is where most of the sugar cane is grown. So we have northern New South Wales all the way up to Cairns. Okay? And it's probably used all the way up into Southeast Asia, right? Producing a lot of sugar cane in places like Thailand. And this is an excellent fungicide at the sensitive stage when you first plant the set. And it prevents something called pineapple disease, which is a fungicide that can cause serious problem right at the early stages of sugar cane growth. So they put this on, they either dip the sugarcane sets in a solution of this stuff, or they put it in a spray rig. And in the instruction manual, it says, when you're finished, if you have any extra dip, or if you have any extra spray, and you haven't sprayed it out on the field, you can just bury it, but make sure that you bury it away from water sources and your house. Okay? So we were contacted by the Department of the Environment and Energy, and they explained this problem to us, because we put in a grant for mercury remediation, and I knew nothing about this, okay? Nothing at all. And they're telling me, you know, this is a fungicide, it's used widely up in Queensland. I'm like, okay, so this is legacy pollution, right? This was used in the 50s, 60s. They're like, oh yeah, but they still use it now. And in fact, It's actually the largest source of mercury emissions in Australia. It's not legally counted as emissions because it's legal to use, and it's used intentionally. So it's not incidental emissions, it's used intentionally. So what can we do? Well, we know that our polymer is actually quite good at pulling this stuff out of solution. All right. So we bought some of this stuff right here. And the manufacturers actually include a dye, so if you spill this, you can actually see where it is. And because our polymer actually binds to oil, it can actually remove the dye as well. And it turns out that the rate is actually the same. And that's very convenient. Because what that allows us to do is make a kit where we put this stuff in a tea bag or we have it bunded in some way. And instead of dumping this by your house, you can put this in for a few hours. You can see the color change and go to clear. And then we can take it out and send this to a mercury recycler, of which there are multiple ones in Australia. And so as part of this project, what we wanted to do was make such a kit. So while this is still legal, perhaps farmers can use this to dispose of their excess fungicide safely. And we're also looking to see, could we actually capture anything that's running off the field? Because there were a lot of unanswered questions. Where does this go? Does it stay in the soil? What form is it in the soil? Does it go into the plant? Or does it just wash off the soil? And where does it go? Okay. And I was assured by the Cane Growers Association, the lobby group for the cane growers, that they've been monitoring soil for 50 years, and there's no accumulation of mercury in the soil. And I said, that is not necessarily a good thing, because where is it going? And of course, what I didn't have on the map before was the Great Barrier Reef right here. And so there's evidence that there's accumulation of mercury in coral, and so we know where this is going now. All right. So what did we learn in these field trials? Well, we put these bunded bags at different sites, and we had, to their credit, the grower that we worked with, he understands that this is a toxic material, okay? And he said, well, you guys better figure out something else that's better. And, you know, good luck, and he was generous enough to let us do some of these tests on his field. But, you know, the risk, why we're really worried, is all of this runs down into a tailwater pit, and when it floods, where does this go? Straight into a neighboring river, out into the city, and eventually out into wherever the catchment is or wherever the river feeds, out into the ocean most likely. And so basically, it comes off so hard and so fast, our material was only able to capture some mercury, but it's absolutely impractical to even treat tailwater or catch the mercury coming off the field. So our recommendation to the government when we had to report this on this project was, you have to make this illegal. That's the only way that this will end. And so that means, from a policy standpoint, providing some incentive to farmers to change their practices. And that's really risky. As someone who grew up farming wheat and corn, it's difficult to change your practices in farming. So however Australia responds to this and their obligations under the Minamata Convention, they need to make sure that there's some insurance or some financial incentive for these cane growers to make a change to a mercury-free fungicide so they're financially supported and they can still make their living growing sugarcane. And so the moral of this story is you have a lot of mercury right at the beginning. It protects it in the short period where it's very sensitive. And as soon as it rains or as soon as they irrigate, they do a lot of flood irrigation, it washes off. That's the moral of the story. It doesn't get stuck in the plant, but all of this goes off the field to wherever the tailwater is collected or runs. All right. And so in our polymer bag, we actually had this separated here so we could dissect each one. And in that first period, within the first 4 weeks where all of it's getting washed off, that stays constant throughout our experiment. So that tells us that we can trap some, okay? And it corresponded to where it was in the soil when we first started the experiment, okay? And it also says that once it's trapped, it doesn't wash off because it didn't change over the 3 months that we did this experiment, all right? But it's impractical to use these bunded bags for how fast this is coming off. So it will have to be made illegal at some point. So we'll take a break before we do the last story on mercury. And so often when I'm abroad giving talks, I like to, you know, take a step back and, you know, appreciate the many interesting things in Australia, whether it's the natural beauty of Moree Alta or the funny creatures that we encounter at Flinders University. So this picture right here, when I was setting up my lab, is a sulfur-crested cockatoo actually tapping on the glass. I'm still, like, amazed by these animals. This is a sign at Flinders University, I believe, on the first day that students arrived at classes. And so I made sure to send a tweet out to wish them well on all the challenges that they'll face in the upcoming semester. This right here, I'm waiting for the bus, the G10, to go back home. A little koala waiting at the bus stop. I think this was the most popular post that Flinders had had at some point. They even wrote me a letter, the communications office. I try to post a lot on Twitter to publicize all the interesting things we're doing in science. This is the most popular thing we've done. So there you go. All right, so let's strap it in for the last part of my talk here, where I'm going to discuss a very challenging problem in mercury pollution. In fact, it's the primary source of mercury pollution globally, and that's artisanal and small-scale gold mining. And so here's an infographic that Louisa Esdale and I prepared that is based off of the UN Environmental Program Mercury Inventory, as well as various papers that estimate the amount of gold that's produced globally, mercury trade, and measured mercury emissions around the planet. And so using these as estimates, here are the hot spots where this is done, where you're using mercury metal, so liquid mercury metal that you probably have all seen or perhaps interacted with. It's excellent at extracting gold from ore. And this has been done historically for thousands of years. Now, the formal mining industry, just to be clear, does not use mercury. They use cyanide, which has its own issues. Cyanide's incredibly toxic, but at least it's biodegradable. The thing about mercury is that it may change oxidation state, but it will always be mercury. And it gradually accumulates in higher organisms. So that's a problem. And so these people are using mercury metal to extract gold. These are primarily in developing nations that have few, if any, economic resources or employment opportunities. So these miners, which are about 20 million people globally, and that includes child labor. Many women are doing this, and mercury is incredibly toxic to unborn children and the fetus. They're involved in this mining. And they're doing this because they have no other means of economic or of income. So they're doing this to make a living. So it's very easy to say we need to ban mercury and make this illegal, because that's done in many parts of the world. Okay? But these people are only doing this to make a living. And they have few other opportunities. So the hot spots, China, Indonesia, most of Africa, actually, and South America are the hot spots of where this is happening. 20% of the world's gold is made by these miners, okay? By people crushing rocks by hand, by pumping rocks that are in riverbeds through sluices, and then amalgamating this with mercury metal, okay? Now, let's see what this actually looks like in practice. So in the 1980s, there was a very famous gold rush in Brazil. This is a site where large gold nuggets were found, and 100,000 people showed up out of nowhere and were encouraged by the government because there were other economic crises at the time. This was a way to support the national economy. And so you have 100,000 people digging rocks and digging and bringing them out of this pit, and they're using mercury left and right to concentrate the gold. I mean, this is incredible, absolutely incredible. And these people, over a period of about 3 years, took out something like 40 tons of gold, some a staggering amount of gold, okay? And most of this gold is used for jewelry or to back certain currencies, okay? So that's another issue we can talk about if you're interested. This is present-day Peru. In the Amazon, this leads to substantial deforestation, okay? Military conflict, extensive mercury pollution. So they're cutting down all of these trees, the same as in Guyana and Ghana as well. So this is a problem in Africa. Right? So it's not unusual for you to have gold rushes where tens of thousands of people descend on an area, they strip it bare, they dig up everything, they mix it with mercury to get the gold out. So we have collaborators in Indonesia through an organization called Pure Earth. And they're an international environmental advocacy group set on their mission is to eliminate pollution, especially in the poorer parts of the world. And so this is a typical mine in outside of Sulawesi. And they have these things called trommels. So they put about 20 kilos of crushed rock in these trommels, and they pour in liquid mercury directly. So this is about 300 grams to a kilo of mercury. And they mill this with some big stainless steel bearings or rods or tungsten rods to mash up the rocks and get everything crushed really fine. And mercury is really dense. I don't know if you've ever picked up a bottle of mercury, but it's 13 grams per mil, so it's very, very dense. So after it forms the amalgam with gold, it sinks to the bottom, and it's very easy to separate. So when they're finished, they have tailings. Most of these are done near riverways, because that's where a lot of the alluvial gold is. They're free gold particles. And so the tailings go straight into the river. Okay, there's no tailings dams, or in the rare cases they are, they're makeshift. So all of this is released directly into the waterways. The same water where they'll do fishing downstream. Okay, much of the mercury that's in these tailings gets beat up into tiny beads that, even though it's so dense, the dirt that sticks to it makes it float. So this mercury flour can travel many kilometers down from where the mining is done and affect people who don't even realize that this mercury is polluting their water. Now, they do recover mercury as much as they can, okay? And then they have the dense amalgam, and so this is quite a few combined together. But this is probably about 80% mercury, but it's a paste now, and it has some gold, silver, and probably some other minerals. And to get the gold, they simply boil off the mercury. So this is a picture of how they've done this in Cambodia. So this is the amalgam here, and they heat it with like an acetylene torch. Sometimes they do this over campfires. Sometimes they do this in their home, in their kitchen where they're cooking food. So the mercury is boiled off directly. Rarely do they recover it. They can in some cases. But if you breathe mercury vapor, it can actually cross your blood-brain barrier, and it's extraordinarily dangerous. It's a neurotoxin. And if you watch clinical interviews of miners who have done this for years, many of them can't pass the matchstick test because they have severe tremors. They can't pick up a matchstick and put it into a cup. Many of the children that are living near these areas have limb deformities. If you're exposed to mercury vapor before you're born, often you'll get a condition called hydrocephalus, where they retain fluid in their skull. It's quite confronting. And if you are interested in learning more about that, there have been many stories in the headlines. Like, I would argue that this is approaching the level of a global crisis. And it's one that you don't hear a lot about. It is covered in the media. And I would encourage you, if you're interested in the effects on child labor, to check out some excellent work, some photographic journalism in National Geographic and also by PBS. But they're often the news stories, especially like these in the New York Times, they often demonize the miners. But these people are typically uneducated, okay? They're doing only what they know to make a living. And that's not what we are trying to do here. We want to actually support them. I actually think banning mercury now can lead to more serious problems, because these 20 million people who rely on that for an income, what are they going to do? And because the Minamata has just been ratified, the signatories, the parties to the treaty, have 3 years to come up with a plan to deal with this problem. And most of them have just been making it illegal without any alternative economic support for the people who depend on this. And of course, these are many areas that are conflict zones. And so what can we do to help these people? And so for the last couple years, we've been working on cheap ways to capture mercury. Because in all of these areas, they're plagued with mercury pollution. The soil, the water, the air that they breathe. And we wrote a call to action because I have to admit, I didn't know a lot about this problem. And as we got more and more into the mercury world, we realized that this is a huge issue. I would actually have it a crisis, at crisis level. So we issued a challenge to the chemistry community to help deal with this, because a lot of other chemists never heard of this. Can we make cheap ways to detect mercury? Can we allow them to use mercury but not expose themselves as much so they don't get sick when they use it? Can we introduce things that are so cheap, maybe it's made from waste, to trap the mercury that they can clean up their air, water, and soil? Or better yet, can we actually introduce an alternative that doesn't involve mercury in the mining? And so we spent a lot of time on the mercury problem. Whoop. Microsoft has decided that the the talk is over. Well, we won't be thwarted.
It's almost right.
I apologize for that. I don't know what happened. There we go. So we're working with collaborators in Mali to perhaps introduce filters that can be used to clean the water that contaminates some of their wells. We're working with Pure Earth to perhaps use our polymer to mill it with tailings. You can see it turn black and you can filter it out to remove mercury from soil. Perhaps they could just mill this with their tailings and dump it because it doesn't actually leach off of this. And that's better than dumping the mercury in the riverways where it can move. We're working with collaborators at RMIT to make disposable masks that when they're, if they're using mercury or why they still use mercury, perhaps we can prevent exposure in the inhalation. But this is still frustrating working on these problems because at the end of the day, we have to have a replacement for mercury. And so that's what we're working on now. So Max Mann, who's in the audience, is an honor student working on this problem. And this was started by a master's student, Salah Abouaji. And this polymer binds to gold better than it does for mercury. Okay, so we can take gold 3, so this is a water-soluble form of gold, not the form of gold that's found in the ore. But if we can get that gold from ore into solution, perhaps we can get it to bind to our polymer. We're sorting out all of the fundamental chemistry about these little gold particles, how they actually form, what oxidation state are they in, we don't know. But we know that if the gold is in water, we can pull it out. And we can get it back pretty easily. You can just dissolve the polymer and the gold metal drops out directly. Okay, that's quite easy. You can also incinerate it, the same thing they basically do with the mercury, they're just boiling off the mercury, and recover this metal. And so what we need to do now is work out a process where we can take gold ore, oxidize it with something cheap to make it water soluble, put in a tea bag of our stuff and pull the gold out. Then you can incinerate it or dissolve the polymer and get the gold back. And so what Max has shown is you can actually use something like calcium hypochlorite or trichlorocyanuric acid. You can buy these at Bunnings. These are common chlorinating agents for your pool. And these are at prices on commodity markets of less than $2 per kilo and $5 per kilo for each of these components here. Mercury, depending on where you're at and the black market economy, usually runs between $20 and $60 per kilo. So this could be competitive for price. Does it work? I'll show you one example here. Max has taken gold metal. So we're going through the full cycle. This can even be doped with contaminants to show that other ions don't interfere. We can oxidize it with bleach or that trichlorocyanuric acid, these pool chemicals. We can actually get this gold to dissolve. This is a bit slow. It might be too slow for inpatient miners who need this to get money to live. But this is comparable to cyanide. This is comparable to formalized mining, okay? And we can just put in a bunded bag, a tea bag of this polymer, and you can incinerate it, and you get excellent recovery, over 90% yield in this full cycle. And so what we're working on now is working with Pure Earth to try to make a fail-safe method so this would actually be used. And so over the next few years, our goal is to implement this at artisanal mines so they can actually make money, they can be supported in their economic development, but they're not using something that will poison them. And so hopefully, when I talk to you again, we'll see less color on this map. And it will be a long road ahead because many well-intentioned efforts have been thwarted in this problem because uptake is not guaranteed in any case, but we're making a good effort. With that, I will conclude my talk. I thank you very much for your attention. I thanked all of the people who were involved in these experiments as we went through the talk. And I need to thank the people who pay for this, the Royal Society, Coca-Cola, the Australian Government Department of Environment and Energy are the main funders for this research. Thank you for your time and attention, and thank you for indulging me with a few extra minutes, Corey.
Thank you, Justin. Wow, you know, I don't know about you, I'm gobsmacked. I know the planet's in a dire mess. That's kind of what I study, but when you just realize the layers of mess underneath all of that, it's even more depressing. But just, it's an incredible thing to see how practical solutions can be generated. And you kind of make me feel a little bit insignificant, Justin. I have to say you're actually fixing some of these problems instead of just telling people about them. So thank you so much for that amazing insight. And we just want to open it up now. We've got about 5-10 minutes of questions. And I'll be intervening to try to keep it nice and balanced. So if anyone wants to ask a question, please feel free. Right here in the front.
We'll wait for the microphone as well because this is recorded. So those of you joining us virtually can hear.
Very quickly, thank you. good evening, everyone. My name is Viviana, and I'm from Colombia. And when you show the picture about gold mining, it's a very big problem in my country.
Yep.
And I feel touched by that topic because you are right. The poor people is extracting gold from the rivers, and they don't have any choice more than using mercury for that. And it's very dangerous, as you said. And these people is just trying to survive because they don't have any choice.
That's right.
And I think this that you show today is a very good solution for us. And I hope that the results of your research can be widespread, and can reach my country at any moment. And I want to ask you if you have think about it in to get or to send that information for of the countries that are implied in that problem, maybe?
So to answer the more general question about making this available, we're trying to make this, this is all open access. We're trying to disclose things before they're actually published. So the people who need this, they're not going to have money to pay for some journal article that's beyond a paywall. So we're trying to make this all publicly available so they can actually adopt it. We actually have contacts in Colombia. And incidentally, Coca-Cola is funding a service project where we're actually trying to remediate some of the mercury in rivers that are contaminated with mercury because of gold mining. But Colombia is quite a challenging area because you're right, you have poor people who are mining for gold, and they're caught between the government, who has deployed the military to destroy their mines, and the people who they're paying tax to, mafia and organized crime, who are taking some off the top. So it's an extraordinarily difficult situation in Colombia, and it's beyond just gold mining.
It's a big problem, but we need help. Definitely.
Yes.
Thank you for that question. Any others? I think we had a question here, yes.
Thank you, that was really exciting. You mentioned, of course, the problem of mercury as a potent neurotoxin. Have you had any inquiries from the medical community if there's any application in terms of chelation therapy for actually treating patients that are suffering from mercury poisoning? Is there any application there?
So, yes, we've been approached by that. We haven't tested it. And so what's done now, if you have mercury poisoning, they pump out your blood, it goes through activated carbon, and so it's very possible that we could use a very similar thing here as well. We haven't done any of those experiments. I have been approached by a few people, but there are only so many hours in the day. So.
Other questions? Over here, please.
Thank you. This might be a bit of a random tangent, but you noticed that you said that you're working on disposable face masks. Is there an opportunity to make reusable ones, considering that those countries often don't have anywhere to dispose of them safely?
Potentially, but I think there is going to be very little confidence that the people that are doing mining using mercury are going to follow any type of chemical hygiene plan. And so the plan is that if it captures the mercury vapor, it converts it into the cinnabar. That's the most common geological form of mercury. It doesn't leach, and so as far as mercury goes, it's probably the safest form. It's not ideal, right? Ideally, you would strip it back off and have a reusable one, but this doesn't work that way.
Any more questions? Right at the front. Oh, well, we'll go you first and then come to you. Is that right?
Sorry, I may have missed it, but is it just a cold process of mixing the canola oil with crude sulfur?
No, you didn't miss it. You missed the very tiny text where I said the temperature of this reaction. But it's run at 180 degrees, so you actually have to heat the reaction or heat the reactants in order to form this polymer. You can do it in a microwave. You can do it in a household microwave. So technically, it's not that complicated to do.
So that's why it's simple enough for one of these people to
that's
make
right.
it themselves.
That's correct.
If they got the canola and the sulfur.
That's right. And I should say it doesn't have to be canola oil. It can be any unsaturated triglyceride. It can be olive oil, sunflower oil, palm oil, cottonseed oil, linseed oil. All of them work.
And then we right at the front.
Yes, thank you. It amazes me that we haven't heard about the mercury in Queensland. Like, we've been hearing for a long time about the sugarcane and the pollution and the waterways, and I've been thinking, oh, yeah, probably nitrogen, I didn't know. Surely a lot of people must have been aware of this for a long time, but it seems to me like with the media and that, they're keeping this quiet.
I would agree with that.
So and how can we get this out to the general public, you know, a bit more?
Justin's working on that.
Yeah.
this is a public lecture here.
Yeah.
We're communicating this problem. But I am confident that Australia will eventually ratify the Minamata Convention, and that fungicide will be illegal in 2 to 3 years.
Mm. So do politicians are aware of this?
Yes.
They are. They're just all keeping it quiet.
That's right.
Because of the farming vote.
Yep. So politically, it's difficult. Again, similar to the mining situation, right, where you have a slim profit margin, and a lot of people do it, and this is what works, and they buy what works, and is legal. So it's very easy to demonize the growers.
Oh, I agree.
And so ultimately, you have to have a policy that makes it illegal, but you phase in alternatives, which are already sold by the same company.
Really?
That makes that.
Not Monsanto, by any chance?
No. So there are alternatives that will be used. They should phase out, but they have to support the growers to make the change.
Question. Just wait for the mic, if you will, please. Thanks.
What interest do you have from the oil industry?
So it's interesting because the oil industry likes to be able to make products from things that they don't have a use for. So they do like, the few interactions I've had, they like the idea of using sulfur to make a value-added product. They like the idea of having a cheap sorbent that in the refining process they can capture mercury. So we are in communication with some very large oil and refinery companies, and that hasn't moved much further than that. But the idea, like our dream, is over the next 10 years establishing a company where we work with them to try to help deal with the unique mercury remediation needs they encounter. But we actually have a company where we use a substantial portion of the profits to help fund the remediation efforts in places where people will not pay for it. So hopefully they, oil, gas, and coal, can subsidize this vision. That's a challenging problem.
Time for one more question. Over here, please.
Just following on from that question about the use of the fungicide in Queensland, have there been any health problems in Australia, or is it all hush-hush?
So I am not aware of any epidemiological study on the effects of this fungicide. But it's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which there are no health effects. Many of the people that we've worked with, and we know that they use this, there are no precautions. And I've heard some pretty crazy stories about people having accidents where they've spilled it on them, and they've been very sick for a long time. So hopefully it will be phased out, but the effects of this could last for years into the future. And this is an extraordinarily potent neurotoxin.
Might partially explain some of the political trends in Queensland.
As someone who's married to a Queenslander, I didn't want to make that joke.
That's why I did.
Well played.
Right, okay. Once again, please let's thank Justin for an amazing talk.
Thank you.
And thank you for attending the Brave Lectures series. We have several more coming up this year, and this will, of course, continue. So if you're interested, just keep an eye out on the Brave website, and we'll be announcing those talks with plenty of time to plan. So I think the next one's in October the 20th, around there. Is that what you said? No.
Towards the end of October.
Watch this space. But thank you very much, and please be safe getting home. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Sorry for going over.
No. It was great. Well done.
Yeah, for like five. And then you're doing this one, like, let's wrap it up.
Well, you've got to catch his attention without disrupting his intention.
Yeah.
You can put those in our recycling
center. I sure can. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you. It was great. Thank you for letting me chew your ear off as well.
Yeah,
well, I'll just wait and see with Sarah what her thoughts are about putting your lecture earlier. I kind of do like the idea of leveraging off that.
I prefer
well.
That, but
I'll... And I'll put that in there as well, that you would prefer. Yeah, lovely. Thank you.
I'll just need...
I might have you as my plan C. I was still just trying to get someone else in if I can. Thank you.
I'm going to be hooked up to all sorts of electrodes tonight. Actually, sleeping at the hospital. Haven't done that in a while.
Well, I hope they get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, I think I have some sort of root blockage in my nasal cavity, but I'll sort that.
Thanks again for coming out.
I really enjoy that. Yeah. Horse's mouth. But I tweeted the crap out of
it. Thanks so much. It'll be great to meet the ecology team. So.
Yeah. Well, let's
sometime in the no rush.
You know, if you guys imagine you do regular lab meetings and stuff, we can do a Friday sort of be in
tomorrow. We do a joint super group meeting or something like that. Be cool. Maybe in like an afternoon some of the students can come to talk.
Like I said, I'm trying to get this health thing kicks up. Talking about side projects that we need to lay out that mercury distribution stuff.
That's pretty scary. I mean, when we're out there digging holes, like, we're getting the results back. These poor guys are doing this thing every year for 50 years.
Wow, they don't be very good. measure, but just thinking about it, a longitudinal study. 5,000 kids in different areas, and you had controls, and you looked at cognitive function, probably relevant to socioeconomic status and everything, you know, prospects post childhood. I imagine that could be massive. And I think it would probably be very big for any farm kids.
Yeah.
But even people who aren't in the farm. I mean, these are all farm towns, like Mary Grove. There's game trucks driving everywhere, right? It's a farming town. But there are people who don't think they realize what they're putting on the field. So Maryborough sure helps us a lot. They do not use it as well as other towns. But they work with growers as part of their agriculture extension.
Is it cheap, by the way, can you stop?
So I bought like 10 acres for like $40.
So what's the alternative? How much more expensive is
that? It's a little bit more expensive.
A little bit? Like 40%
more? I would have to check. I can't remember.
Because the thing is,
I think what they're doing is they're trying to sell out what they have. That's my guess.
Right. And then they'll sign off. And then would they put in some sort of subsidy?
Nobody knows.
That's the easiest way out.
All right, mate. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, boy.
Enjoy it.
Cheers.
I was surprised that she. All right, shall we go to the next?
Sorry, I had to rush and stuff at the end, Max.
That's all right.
Computer got excited and shut down. I think we've all been saying.
Yeah,
that's the most important thing. I probably need to shut this bad boy down.
Yeah.
That's because it